If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. Nick Petrie is here. He's the a man behind the Peter Ash series. The latest is The Dark Time. And Nick, welcome. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Listen, is it true that your first writing was a high school soap opera?
It was. It was. I was terrible at everything else. They, for some reason, they ended up making me the editor in chief. But my freshman year, your freshman year usually writes sports, and I'm not a sports guy. I had no idea how to write about wrestling or football or anything. The sophomore year, we were supposed to, you know, become, you know, learn news, and I was never all that good with facts. I started writing features my junior year, and then I could sort of play with stuff. And then my senior year, I could assign my own story. So I wrote this 8-part soap opera featuring very thinly veiled versions of my friends and my enemies and making fun of everybody. So
on net, did you win friends or lose friends over that?
I think I won friends. It was a really interesting thing to, that was my first experience of sort of like being a semi-public person. I mean, this is high school, but people would stop me in the hall to say, oh, I read your thing in the paper and it was really funny. And so, you know, there's a weird thing about being a writer. So much of it is private. So much of it is you are by yourself in a room, you know, or in a quiet place in the library or whatever, and you're telling yourself a story. And then the other part of it is like what we're doing right now, which is, you know, sort of talking to readers and talking about writing. And I really like both of those parts of this job.
But it probably teased you a little bit with the public feedback, right? I mean, gave you a bit of the itch?
Oh, sure. I mean, part of it was the fun of writing the story, but the other was, you know, having an audience. And I know there are plenty of people who are just writing for themselves, and I think that's great. You know, and people make, you know, art for themselves to put on their own walls or to give to their friends or their family. But I think for many creative people, it's really a conversation between you and your audience. And that is kind of what feeds me through those solitary times.
You know, there's another way to go through that a little bit, in that I've always viewed any book as an equation, right? I mean, you provide most of it, but then there's the plus reader that gets you to the equals. And the equal is it can be very different for every reader.
Well, the sum is greater than the parts for sure as well. I mean, that's the thing that I think a lot of writers don't really understand or don't necessarily understand, is that you present something and it forms a picture in somebody else's head, and they are bringing, you know, people that they know who are like you, your characters, or places that they know that are like the place you're writing about, and their own attitudes and thoughts and hopes and fears. And that's why I think writing is so powerful in a way that, you know, for me, streaming TV or going to the movies, that's powerful in its own way, but it's a very different kind of conversation.
I talked to Kazuo Ishiguro, the novelist, one time, a couple times, but one time he said something that was kind of striking to me, in that he didn't like going to book readings anymore or audience participation, because he thought that what the audience was taking out of it, or the audience was knowing things, picking up things that he was writing, that would then get in his head. So he may well be very good at this particular sort of metaphor or something, I don't know, that he's not quite aware of. And then when his readers tell him about what he's actually doing, it starts to mess him up a little bit. Does that make any sense to you?
I guess it makes sense. I mean, Kazuo Ishiguro and I have very different, we write very different things, and we have very different careers. You know, my goal is to publish a book a year and to be out in front of an audience, you know, every year to talk about stuff. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of Kazuo Ishiguro. The Remains of the Day had a big impact on me, you know, 30 years ago. But I think when you're writing, you know, what I write is called commercial fiction. And I the goal is to try to sort of transcend that a little bit. But, you know, it's a different, feedback is, I think, more important when you are writing for a larger audience.
So then does it work for in reverse, in that you might end up amplifying some things that you see are playing well out at those book gatherings?
Not so much that as I'm paying attention to the kinds of questions that people ask me. A great example of that is, so when the first book came out called The Drifter, I was, you know, 2 or 3 weeks before it came out, I kind of freaked out because it's about a war veteran coming home and sort of trying to figure out kind of how to live his life after that, you know, sort of life-changing experience. And I'm not a combat veteran. I'm not a veteran of any sort. And I had done a lot of research. I talked to a lot of people, but I didn't really understand. Like, I just was freaked out that I was going to somehow misrepresent either myself or this experience.
Or appear presumptuous, maybe.
Yes, yeah, right. Yeah. And then I started doing these events, and people who read the book would tell me how much it meant to them. There were these two women at the Greenfield Library who came up at the very end of the signing line, and they said, we're sisters, our husbands both fought in Vietnam, and your book helped us understand how to talk to them about that. And like, that was a really powerful thing to hear. And I still get messages from people all the time. And so that made me feel like I had a real responsibility to continue to do this well and to do right by these people that this book was talking about and also speaking to. That kind of a feedback has had a huge impact. Sure.
Have you got negative feedback from vets who say that you triggered them in one way or another, or that you didn't represent it well? I mean, it's...
No, in fact, it's the opposite. People really sort of have come out of the woodwork. This thing still, I talk about this often, but it really has stuck with me. I got this Facebook message from a young man who said that he'd spent the summer trying to figure out the best way to kill himself. And then somebody gave him my book, The Drifter, and it made him realize that he wasn't going crazy, that he had post-traumatic stress. And he'd gotten some help and he felt hopeful, and he attached a picture of himself in his dress uniform with his wife and his three little kids. And like, that just kind of knocks my socks off.
Just hearing that, I mean, such a gift that you gave him, but that he in turn returned to you. I mean, what a gift he gave to you.
I think the negative feedback I sometimes get is from people who are, I got a Twitter message from somebody who was basically, who cares about Peter and his girlfriend? I just want Peter to kill more dudes. And like, that's not what I'm doing. Sometimes, you know, this is a crime novel, so things happen. But if you're not interested in those relationships, this book probably isn't for you.
This is a relationship book, right? I mean, in fact...
Well, they all are. Well,
right, the series, I should say. I read somewhere about your readership, that you're more likely to have a female reader than a male reader, which is...
I am.
...unusual for your genre, isn't it? I mean, I would think that... Well, I don't know, but it would seem to me to be more men than women.
Well, I think it depends on how you think about what you think my subgenre is. So if you look at true military fiction authors, right? So Tom Clancy is a great example. Somebody like Mark Graney, although he's also kind of more espionage. Brad Taylor is a great example. Mm-hmm. You know, it's leaning heavily into the military and into sort of all of the... you know, sort of the jargon and the minutiae and like what it's really like to be, you know, part of this, whatever. Jack Carr is also a great example. And so if you think that's the group I'm in, then yeah, that overwhelmingly skews male and also older. You know, that's not what my friends who write that think that I do. They think I'm writing something that's much more like Lee Child's Jack Reacher books, which is sort of, there's a military character, but it's set in America. It's about solving problems and helping people. And I'm not, you know, the military is sort of a one element of the background of the character. It's not really part of the day-to-day of the book.
Great relationships he brings from the military, right?
And, right.
In June as well. I'm kind of jumping around. I apologize for that, but I want to talk more about Peter. But first, I also read somewhere that you learned about, soaked in the knowledge of the way vets deal with coming home because you are a contractor or you're a woodworker?
I have been a contractor and I have been a woodworker, but the contact you're thinking about is when I was working as a freelance home inspector. So if you bought a house, you hired a guy like me to tell you what was wrong with it. And I had, you know, there's the surge that started in 08. And in about 2010, I started realizing that I had all these clients coming home from the surge, which was really a horrific time. That was the civil war in Iraq was at its height. These were folks who really had been through the ringer. And one of the funny things about being a home inspector is, like, I wasn't part of their home, you know, community. I wasn't part of their military community. So with your, you know, if you've been in combat, you don't really tell your friends and family what you've been through because you don't want them to carry that weight and they won't get it. You also don't necessarily talk with your military friendship community about those things because that community values toughness and sucking it up and getting the job done. But some schmo shows up at this house that you're buying and you spend literally it's 3 or 4 hours, depending on the size of the house. And, you know, it's a big moment in the life of anybody when you're buying a house, especially your first house. And I'm really interested in people. I'm a fairly chatty guy. And so we would have a conversation. And by the end, we're all down in, you know, I'm down in the basement with my clients. The mother-in-law is upstairs with the wife measuring for curtains or where does the couch go or what color are we going to paint the kitchen? And it's just me and some guy in an army t-shirt.
You know, it's
and I say, so you're in the army. And he would say something to me knowing he was never going to see me again. I was a safe person to talk to. So that's kind of where all that came from.
There's an interesting dynamic in that relationship too, because I always tell people, okay, the inspector's here to tell you everything that's wrong with the house, right? So you're going to tell the prospective buyers every minor thing. They're there in a very hopeful state because, you know what I mean? So they're just, I think your next character, maybe Nick, should be a home inspector.
Well, it's funny.
There's ripeness there.
Yeah. I never thought of that, of my job is to tell people everything that was wrong. I think I felt like my job was to educate people about how the house works and what was done well and what needed some help. Because all homes, you know, have some stuff that are right and some stuff that needs repair. That's just the nature of it.
Yeah, it's just the way it goes. Okay, so let's tell me about Peter Ash, in that the way you write about his PTSD is the word that comes to my mind is subtly. And I don't know if that's intentional to you, but it's not, it's always there, but it's not overwhelming. Or I don't know if I'm getting that right. Explain that for me.
Well, so Peter calls his post-traumatic stress the white static, and he's claustrophobic. And so it shows up when he's, you know, depending on the situation, when he's inside or when he's in a tighter space, but it's evolved. So in the first book, the white static is essentially a full-blown character by itself. It is a huge piece of that book. But I also wanted to, going back to sort of the feedback from the audience piece, I wanted to show how Peter could get better. So he starts out basically living in this truck, can't really function in society, can't be inside more than 20 minutes. And I wanted to show my readers, those people who were also struggling with this stuff. So what are the things that you do to find your way out of that? And so now by book 9, which is what the dark time is, it's, you know, that experience, the white static still lives in Peter, and sometimes it shows up and sometimes it doesn't, but it doesn't define him, which is really how, and again, I know lots of people who have been through some version of this, some harder than others. And the people who successfully make their way through sort of make friends with this and learn how to work with what it is. And so that's, you know, there are books where it's again, sort of more prominent. And others where it's less so.
Well, I guess in the dark time, then my introduction to Peter Ash is it's sort of a companion, not pro or con, but someone you're traveling with. I didn't think I'd be traveling with Karl Marx in this book, but maybe I was, right? So this term that I didn't, the creative destruction, where these companies buy up smaller and smaller companies till all of the wealth is concentrated. And there are concerns with AI and big tech and all of that. This book said in Seattle that is happening. It sounds like it's a current phenomenon. But I think it's June who points out that it's actually a quote from Karl Marx. And so what were you saying there? I mean, do you find that we might be heading toward revolutionary times, or is this is going to be sort of a chasm?
I think times are changing really quickly, and there's a lot that people are concerned about. And I think AI in particular is like, if you think that the offshoring of factories to, you know, China, if you think that was sort of a 25-year process, and if you think that had a big effect on America and had a huge effect on America and on American politics and on the American landscape, frankly, and on the American economy, like if you think that was a big deal, you know, if what even the naysayers say about AI comes to pass, we're going to see a much bigger disruption in a much shorter period of time. So I think it's going to be a very interesting moment.
I was just, I just this week read an article, I think it was on Forbes.com, from someone in the business who said that it's unimaginable for most of us who aren't ahead of the curve. And if you want to keep your, it's time to pony up. It's time to catch up, because it is going to be a life altering sort of phenomenon. I want to talk, you talk a lot about SET, and there are a couple of things that bring that to mind, but just to keep on this Karl Marx and the, you know, the terrible things that are happening around the world, there's another scene where, Peter, he's with his friend Lewis, and June is there, and they're at a gas station that where it's a people helping people sort of situation. Everyone's in the same boat, and it's not a good boat. And I think it's Lewis who said that it almost renews your faith in humanity. Right. I'm imagining that was a central message you were trying to get to, that we can deal with this AI and come out on top, or at least
not just AI. Right. We are all going through a cultural cataclysm, a political cataclysm, whatever your set of beliefs are, wherever you are in the political spectrum, everybody is feeling like kind of like the world is coming to an end in a way. Right. Mm-hmm. And I wrote this book because I had those feelings, and I was trying to understand. You know, I was thinking about my son who's 25 and a programmer. Like, what is his future going to be like? How is the world going to change for all of our kids? But in writing this book, I really came to that sense of hope that we are all in this together. And if we can kind of pull our shit together and start to see each other as human beings, then we'll be just fine no matter what happens.
Yeah, I was going to be a smartass and only ask you questions prompted by AI. I actually did it. Search for Nick Petrie interview questions. I threw it away. I didn't do it, but location's always important in your books. I know you had one in Milwaukee not too long a while ago, but this is in Seattle, the Pacific Northwest, and I get that. I get where you want to go different places, and it becomes a character in books. But I again read in one of the interviews or somewhere that you did that you don't visit your locations.
Oh, no, I always visit my locations.
No, but not until you're well into the book.
Yeah, typically not, because I don't really know what I'm looking for. So I do a lot of, you know, sort of online research. I do a lot of reading kind of as I'm beginning a book or even before I start a book. But I want to go like, you know, I wrote this book set in Denver where there's this chase scene. And I wanted to go and like retrace the chase scene. Like, did I have it right? Where the, you know, I do some of that on Google Maps, but like, what does it feel like? What is it, you know, and you also don't know, you know, I wrote a book set in Memphis, and the, when I went to visit all of the tulip trees, the flowers had all fallen to the gutters, and you could smell those rotting flowers. And that just was to me like Memphis in a nutshell. I don't know what I'm looking for until I'm partway through. And even then, I don't know what I'm going to find.
Do you ever get to a place and say, this is the wrong place?
Yeah. I wrote a book that I was going to set in Detroit. Cause I went to school in Ann Arbor at Michigan, and I've bummed around Detroit.
I think that took 25 minutes, Nick. That's pretty good.
To what?
For a Michigan grad to point out where they went to school.
I'm just trying to point out my connection to Detroit anyway. And I just like, I had this idea, and it just, I wrote the same 10,000 words over and over again. And finally my wife was just like, try something else. And so I did, but that's not, I mean, I often iterate, you know, I'll write the first chapter of four different books before I sort of land on the one that kind of has legs. That's a pretty common process for me.
What's a pantser?
Writers talk about process a lot. It's like, how do you write? Because we all think we're crazy, and we want to know if other people are also crazy, other writers are also crazy. And so one of the ways that writers differentiate themselves is whether you're a plotter, whether you basically write an outline and plot out your book in advance, or whether you're a pantser, which means a seat of the pants writer, which is what I am. So I begin with sort of a vague idea and a premise for a chapter. And I just, you know, if it starts out and I have more questions than answers, then I just keep going to find out what happens.
If you are looking back on one of the books you've read and you find a perfect plot twist or a perfect sentence, which are you prouder of?
Well, probably the sentence. I probably put more effort into crafting the prose. The plot stuff, sometimes there's some arm wrestling, but mostly it just sort of shows up. You know, I get stuck all the time, but when the solutions come, it feels like it's, I have nothing to do with it. They just appear.
Right. I was talking off air about whether you knew Brad Meltzer. I talked to Brad a couple of weeks ago, and I've talked to him many times over the years, and he's got sort of a nod to Brad Thor in his most recent book. I know there's a real fraternity with you crime writers. And do you ever slip sort of nods at other writers in your books?
Oh, I do. I my friend Don Bentley, who is currently writing the Mitch Rapp books, I've known since before he was published, when I was just published. And in a recent book, I made him a guy with a porn stash and a comb over selling used cars.
Perfect. That's it.
I made a neighbor a surgeon with a business doing penile enhancements. So I have fun with this kind of thing.
That's the way you got to go. Well, listen, Nick Petrie, The Dark Time of Peter Ash novel. It was great to talk to you. I appreciate your time. And I would ask you to say go Cubs.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear that. That wasn't clear.
Yeah. I guess not everyone knows you're sitting in Milwaukee.
Go Packers? Is that what you meant for me to say?
Well, how'd they do this year? I don't remember.
Yeah, I know. You can laugh now.
Another year will come. Great to talk to you. I really enjoyed the book. As I told you, this was my first Peter Ash book I read. I'll read others and look forward to the next one.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate the conversation.
I'm glad you listened to Steve Bertrand on Books. I'd love to hear from you. My email is stevebertrandonbooks@gmail.com. It'd be great if you subscribe to the podcast as well. You can do that at Spotify or the podcast icon on your iPhone or wherever you get your podcast. We should be available. For now, I'm Steve Bertrand saying thanks very much for listening. Keep turning those pages.